Tell us briefly about your meeting with the two senses of one of your novels.
Yes, well, that was a novel called The End of the Nylon Age, written before the covers. And it was accepted for publication, but in those days, if the editors thought that the novel was controversial, they sent the manuscript to the censors, otherwise they sent page proofs. And I was invited there, and there were two of them, a youngish woman, about in her 30s, and an old man. And the woman said, well, comrade, we couldn't recommend this manuscript for publication. I said, why? And said, it's a pornography, which surprised me, because if you could read it, it's totally Victorian, you know. So I said, well, can you show me some of the pornographic passages? And she had a whole list of them. And she said, well, right on page 6, I can't read it, I would have to blush. Or on page 8, well, you can't ask me as a woman to read this. And she went on like that. And then the old man said, well, give it to me, Mary, I'll read it. And he read a longish passage which described a young woman in a beautiful, shiny dress, doing her makeup, and she was smoking a cigarette and inhaling, and her bosom under the shiny cloth, you know, swelled and fell. And he went on reading, and he said, well, Mary, where is the pornography? And she said, you've just read it, the word. And the word was bosom. That was considered in socialist realism a pornographic word. So I got mad and told her, well, if you want me to use a more folksy expression, I can. And that was the end. They threw me out, you know.
What is the essence, or was the essence, of socialist realism in art?
Well, that depends on whether you want to hear reality or official definitions. There are many of them. Nobody really knows, you know, because I remember in the 50s when Sholokhov, the Nobel Prize winner, who is regarded as the probably representative of this strange literary trend or school or method, was in Prague. He was interviewed by an editor who is still active in Prague in the underground. And he asked him, well, comrade Sholokhov, what is socialist realism? And Sholokhov said, Chod znaet, which means the devil only knows. So who can really know? But I think the best definition of socialist realism you can find in 19th century American literature. You know, the name of the writer slips me. He was one of the minor American classics who said once that the rosiest aspects of American life are the most American. And that's socialist realism, because you describe the rosiest aspects of life. And of course, we know from centuries of experience that the rosy aspects usually are just on the surface, that under the surface there is reality, and that's the provenience of literature. But socialist realism simply gives you an illusion of reality.
How did the Czech Stalinist political cultural system, which was very tough, defreeze so quickly to allow the cultural freedom?
Well, it seemed to be very quick, but in fact it had started right after Stalin died, you know. And then with the secret speech by Khrushchev, that was such a shock to these true believers, especially the young ones, that some of them just were, I had the impression that some of them are going to commit suicide because the whole world collapsed, you know. So that started in 1954, you know. But in the 50s, the Stalinist faction in the party was still very strong. So the more liberal faction, or whatever you want to call them, were just gaining momentum slowly. And then they won in the 60s. In the early 60s, they took over the party, which doesn't mean that there were no Stalinists, you know. The situation was never so clear-cut. But the liberals had simply more influence in the 60s. The president, for instance, was a Stalinist. So there were constant battles between the president and the filmmakers and the writers. So it seemed to be so sudden, such an explosion. But it had been in preparation for some 10 years, maybe.
But it was essentially, even the liberal part of the faction, they were setting the limits, what was possible, and told you what you couldn't go beyond.
Oh, yes, of course, they were. They were still, you know, communist Marxists who believed in the monopoly of power. They only thought that the power should be used more intelligently.
How is it possible, particularly in the cinema, for the new wave to develop after being schooled in Stalinism and socialist realism?
Well, I think that is not so difficult to explain, because all these prominent names like Miloš Forman, Němec, Věra Chytilová and others were students at the Film Academy in the early 50s and mid-50s. And as students of the Film Academy, they were shown excellent Western films, you know, like films by Orson Welles and others, French films. They had two screening days every week, and they watched films from 8 in the morning until 10 in, at night. And they were surrounded by a city which was full of cinemas that played trash. So they saw the difference between what was presented to them as the ideal, the socialist, realist film, and what was presented to them as a privilege, because they were students of film and they were supposed to learn the technical tricks from Orson Welles. Well, technical tricks they did learn, but they also learned to see that cinema can be a serious art and that it can tell some truthful things about life. So then when the political atmosphere became more liberal, they used that experience and suddenly you had this, again, sudden, you know, explosion of excellent films, which looked like a miracle. But again, it had been prepared in the 50s by this strange thing.
What was the impact, the social impact on ordinary Czechs of going to the cinemas and seeing some of these new wave films for the first time?
Well, you know, they were, the films that you know in the West, the best ones, were really art films. And they had a limited audience, you know, at that time. I think that the, what you would call the general audience, still wanted to see comedies, you know. But the impact on people, on young people who are interested in art and on artistically minded people was immense. Because in order to understand the impact, you would have to be familiar with the ordinary films that were being still made in the 60s. And you would see the terrible difference between a Black Peter, which was the first film by Foreman, is sometimes called Peter and Paula, which showed, you know, an apprentice, as apprentices really are, interested in girls, not interested in that boring job. Well, that was impossible. This presentation of reality was impossible before that. If you are an apprentice in a socialist realist film, you had to be an enthusiast, you know, trying to learn your trade. So that was, the impact was immense, you know.
What was the meaning of the party and the guests?
Well, there, it's a film about a police state, actually. You know, and one of the ideas of communism, which was never, of course, expressed in so many words, is that we do the revolution in spite of the feelings of the people. We will force the masses into happiness, because we know better. The masses are stupid. You know, Lenin considered the masses stupid. So that's why he created this avant-garde of the proletariat as a sort of club of besserwissers, as the Germans say. So we will force the people to be happy, even against their wishes. And that's what the film is about. You know, this host invites guests, and obviously many of them are very uneasy. And one of them decides to leave the party. And so he sends dogs after him, and the film ends, you know, with the screen blackening, and you can hear the barking of those hounds of Baskerville, you know, obviously hunting the man who decided not to be happy.
And people who saw that film would understand.
Oh, yes, yes. They did understand. It's a very demanding film, of course. You have to have some experience with modern literature, with Beckett, and even Kafka and things like that. But also, since the people had, you know, for instance, we understand Kafka, I think, even not very educated people can understand him better than most people in the West. Because, you know, if you take the trial, a man is being arrested and he doesn't know why. And in the end, he perishes and he never learns why. Well, this is something that in Kafka's time was just a nightmare. But then it became reality for many people. So people did understand that film very well.
Turning now to broader political issues, do you think that the liberal communists who were involved in developing the Prague Spring had a clear idea of what socialism of the human face really meant?
Well, I don't think people ever have clear ideas about revolutionary movements. You know, they have ideals, but they started the, you know, the system, the Stalinist system was so oppressive that you simply reacted against it, and so did they. Their idea was obviously to liberalize it. I don't think they intended to permit the activities of other political parties, for instance. But once they started this avalanche, so suddenly, you know, the old social democrats claimed a right to have their social democratic party. And various other groups, like the political prisoners, organized themselves into a club. And then the non-party people organized themselves into a club of the non-party people. So suddenly the what they call the National Front, which is supposed to be a sort of general organization of various socialist clubs and and movements and so on, became a real national front, which was composed of voluntary organizations. So I don't think they had a very clear idea. They just knew what they didn't want. But how this should, to where it should lead, that was probably very difficult, you know, to foresee.
Did you think the idea, one of the ideas of being pluralistic in some ways, but still having the leading role of the party,
yeah.
Do you think that was a feasible?
Well, you know, I think they based this on that Italian communist who was in jail under Mussolini, what was his name, you know. Not Togliatti, the one who perished in jail. Yes, Gramsci, who said something about that if the party keeps its leading role, but then persuades the masses that it was right, then it could abandon that formal leading role and be supported by the masses. Well, I don't know whether that is not just another utopian dream, you know. But the fact is that although towards the end of the Prague Spring, shortly before the invasion, the party, I don't think they were in full control of what's going on. But on the other hand, they had really very much great support from the people, because, you know, the Czech people, with all their political experiences, are, as far as politics are concerned, are pretty sophisticated. And most of them realize that unless we support the party in this effort, it will lead to disaster. So the support for Dubček was tremendous, you know. There were, of course, you always have these extremist groups who just don't mind. I remember when they abolished censorship, so Dubček used to meet with journalists and ask them to, he told them, well, we have no censorship now, but I ask you not to write about certain issues which are touchy and so on, and they promised. But of course, if you don't have censorship, you always find someone who will ignore any such, you know, wishes of the leader, and they started, and some people started to writing about controversial issues, which led them to Soviet protests and all that. So they didn't have the situation fully in hand. But I don't think it was a dangerous situation for socialism in Czechoslovakia. It would have become a different socialism that we have them now, you know, with probably with the role of the party being less prominent than it is now. But who knows, you know, this is now a historical past and nobody can really say what would have happened.
What happened to you and other leading writers after the Soviet invasion in the period of normalization?
Well, I saw very soon that there was simply no future for me as a writer, because I was a controversial writer, you know. My books, several of them, were had been confiscated. So I saw that unless I recant or start toting the line, I would not be able to exist as a writer. And I was too old to go back to the underground. You know. I was in the underground in the 50s. You know, we were not called dissidents in those days, but we met secretly and so on. But then I was young. And when the Russians invaded, I was already 46. So I decided to go to the West and try my luck there. And I was probably one of the lucky ones who found good jobs and who were able to continue writing and publishing.
Does the writer, the intellectual, have a different role in Eastern Europe than in the West?
Well, I think there are several reasons. Certainly in Bohemia and Moravia, the writers traditionally had a very important role. And that has historical reasons and also reasons, other reasons. The historical reasons are that simply the Czech nation, the Czech language, almost died out in the 18th century under the Habsburgs. You know, the intellectuals spoke German and most of the schooling was in German. So then with the romantic movements, you know, the Czech patriots, who many of them probably spoke very bad Czech, you know, tried to somehow revivify the language. And they did it mainly through translations first and then through writing their own books. So that it became a must for an intelligent person to read fiction and poetry. And that turned into a habit. So that people read serious fiction who in the West would probably read Harlequin romances or something like that. And the second reason was that for the past, 50 years now, the nation lived under very strict totalitarian regimes, first the Nazis, then the communists, with censorship. So that good literature, good fiction, good poetry has become a sort of forbidden fruit. So when it happens that something goes through, you know, people will read it.
So these intellectuals don't talk only to themselves?
Beg your pardon?
The intellectuals don't talk only to themselves, but lots of other ordinary citizens take note of them.
Oh, yes, sure, yes. It's a traditional role. Because the country under the Habsburgs, it was much freer than it is now, but still there were restrictions. So the traditional role of the writer was not just to write books, but also to act as a spokesman for the nation.
What is the size of the Czech publishing now in exile?
Well, I think it's quite sizable. You know, me and my wife have a publishing house in Toronto called the 68 Publishers, and we have published already 190 titles. We have been in existence for 14, 15 years now. So we publish about 25 titles per year, and we don't have any employees, just one secretary. So it's a medium-sized publishing house, and we are not the only publishing house. There are several publishing houses in Europe. So altogether, my estimate would be that since the Soviet invasion, between 400 and 500 titles, if not more, appeared in exile.
And how do some of these titles get back into Czechoslovakia?
Well, they are smuggled, you know. There are people who smuggle them. And then there are all these old mothers and fathers, retired people who get permission to visit their children in the West. And some of them are courageous. They hide the books under their clothing, you know, and smuggle them back. And so my estimate is that about between 100 and 200 copies of every title make it back. But the people who own them in Czechoslovakia don't keep them for themselves. They act as lending libraries. You know, they have lists of interested parties, and whoever is on the list can keep the book for only, I think, 48 hours, and then he must pass it to the next person, so that after 1,000 readings the books fall apart. That's the only complaint we hear, that we should publish hardcover books. But we can, because it's a mail-order thing.
How important to the Czech people living in Czechoslovakia is the existence of these publishing houses outside and the sort of support they offer?
Well, I think it's very important. I can judge by the number of picture postcards that we received every summer when people leave Czechoslovakia for Yugoslavia or for Romania, Bulgaria, for Poland, and they send us postcards from their vacation. Usually signed only by their first names, but saying, like, keep on the good work, and we are glad that you exist, and thank you for all the beautiful books, which is very encouraging. And then, you know, there are even signals sent to us through officially published books. It's incredible. But, for instance, recently I've read a book by a very young author, which was officially published by one of the establishing houses, which ends in the sentence, "And then I thought about the boy I'm going to meet in Prague. Damn, I must have read it somewhere." Well, that's the end of The Cowards, where the Danny says, "And then I thought about the girl I'm going to meet in Prague." So this is an obvious signal to me that I'm still being read. You know, I have a colleague at the university in the English department, Rosemary Sullivan, who is a very pretty young woman, young professor, and she visited Prague. And on her first night in Prague, she went just for a walk and saw a group of young people sitting somewhere. So she approached them, and when they realized that she was talking English, they started talking English to her. And when they found out that she was from Canada, they asked, "Well, do you know Škvoretský in Canada?" And she said, "Well, he's my colleague. He teaches in my department." And she was hers, of course. Then the next 4 days, they just showed her around. And these were people who were in their early 20s. That means that they were probably babies or not even born when I left, you know. They are, of course, university students. So they still, that only shows that people keep following the developments of Czech literature in the West.
How do you account for the cultural renaissance of the 60s?
Well, I think that, you know, there have always been very many talented people in the arts. But when the regime is too rigid, so they cannot really bring their talents to the flowering. And then when the regime eases off a little and becomes more liberal, so suddenly it looks like an explosion. But it's simply pent-up energies which suddenly appear and produce and bring the fruit.
Was the Stalinist period and the brutality in some way helping to produce, making people more creative, sharper?
Well, I'm sure it was. I'm always saying my students that the best thing that can happen to a writer is to go to war, provided that he survives. Because it's such a terrific experience that you have to be very stupid not to produce an acceptable novel. And the same is true about repression. You know, people who survive have the experience of Stalinism or Nazism is so dramatic and full of real, shocking, cruel, bloody things that Czech writers never had any problem with finding topics. You know, you just pick them up on the street. You have too many things to tell, you know. So in that respect, totalitarianism is very inspiring, provided that there comes a time when you can publish it.
How important for ordinary Czechs was the role of writers in their works in the 60s and late in the 70s?
Well, I think it was much more important than, let's say, in the democratic societies for several reasons. The main of them is the historic, the tradition. And the other is that, for instance, there is no free press in totalitarian countries. So people, the only section in the papers people read and believe is the sports page. Otherwise, they just skim through it, and they know that they won't find the truth about the important issues. But they know that they can find some sort of human truth in good fiction, even under censorship, because people learn to read between the lines and writers learn to express things indirectly. So that fiction, especially fiction and drama, to a great extent, also replaces the role of journalism. So that's why it was and has always been very important.
How intense and brutal was the repression after the Soviet invasion?
Oh, that was very brutal. You know, they expelled, I don't know how many, tens of thousands of people from the party. And of course, many, many writers were banned from publication. We, in our publishing house, we published a dictionary of banned Czech writers, which has 500 entries, contemporary writers, 500 entries. I'm not saying that all these people are geniuses. Of course, there are, many of them are average or even worse than average. But they are writers. They have a right to express themselves, and they are banned. So imagine that in a country of, this is just Czech literature, and there are only about 10 million Czech, and you have 500 writers who are not permitted to publish. If you multiply it by 20 times, you would get the number of American writers that would be banned under such a regime. So it was very brutal and very widespread. And
how has this brutal repression broken the spirit of writers and of the Czech people in general?
No, it hasn't. It has, of course, made many writers into cynics and careerists, but not all of them. I think not even the majority of them. And then, you know, if you follow the literary scene in Bohemia, there are not only the extremes, the dissidents and then the officially published writers, there is a gray zone in between. Many of the young writers who want to see themselves in print are very decent and very good and very talented, and they try to do as much as they can within the limits of censorship. And then there are such writers as Bohumil Hrabal, you know, the man who wrote The Closely Watched Trains, among many other things. He is simply so popular and so loved by the people that although they tried for many years to suppress him, they simply couldn't. And now he's publishing, and every time a new book by Hrabal appears, it immediately disappears from bookshelves because every day is after it. And so there is a gray zone, you know, gray transitions.
What is it about the jazz section that really offends the Czech government?
Well, they started as a, they were permitted initially, you know, that was a group of enthusiasts who applied for permission to form a jazz section of the Czech Musicians Union, and they were given permission, and whoever gave them the permission didn't think far enough. He thought, well, this is another organization, and you know, organizations in totalitarian countries are not supposed to be too active, they are supposed to follow orders. They didn't follow orders, they became too active. And it turned into a spontaneous movement with thousands of young people supporting it and many thousand members. So the party didn't like it. They don't like people to be too active. That was the reason why they were after them and started making trouble for them, not jazz music. Because jazz music is more or less tolerated now in communist countries because it doesn't have mass following. That's rock and roll now. Rock and roll has mass following, so all the guns are aimed at the men with the guitars, you know. But jazz as such is even supported in many cases because the records are exported as proof that we are very liberal.
And was it the involvement of young people particularly?
Yeah, that bothered the government. That was the real reason that bothered the government, because the support came mainly from students, high school students, you know, very young people. And the jazz section, because they started banning their concerts, so they spread their activities. They started organizing art exhibitions. They started publishing books, which the official publishing houses would not touch. They, for instance, published a beautiful novel by Hrabal, which was never published by the government publishing houses. And of course, that was a big success. It's now going to be published in English. So they spread into other fields, other activities, and the government simply couldn't tolerate it.
Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
Yes.